Hello, Jimmy.
Hello, Angela.
This is Books Are Good. Actually. Good. I'm glad we're trying a different opening. Just saying fuck it.
Sorry.
No, I like it. I like it.
No. Next time we go back to the regular.
Okay. All right.
I was just fucking around.
Look, we're having fun on
much like the subject of this month's books, just fucking around, taking nothing seriously.
All right, but for month of April, we're reading Socialist States of the Environment, Lessons for Eco-Socialist Futures by Salvatore Ingel Di Mauro. And let's roll right into it. I guess I'll go first. I think last time I did, or you did Thoughts and Feels first. Yeah, so I think the presentation of this book was like really, really good. There's a lot of just how do we do comparisons between different societies, like economically, like ecologically, like how does like our current methods do or do not work? How they like falter in some way. So I thought that was like really nice to kind of have like, let's just go over how we do comparisons and even let's go over what a state socialist or socialist state is, because that is also always up into debate, because there's a lot of people who would just say, well, this country wasn't because they didn't do X, Y, Z of whatever, you know, Marx said we like to not do that. And they did it. So now they're not a socialist state, which is like, but no. And then I thought overall the kind of the proof of just kind of the like, okay, here's what they did during this time. Yes, they did a lot of industrialization because of they needed to catch up and also not get immediately obliterated. So, like, yeah, things went high, and then they start low, and then, you know, things kind of work out. And also, I felt like sometimes it was, like, a little bit, like, kind of overstated a little bit. Just so, like, yes, they did awful things. Like, yes, like, they sent people to gulags and all this other shit. And I'm just like, you already said that at the beginning of this book. Like, I don't know why we need to keep bringing it up. Like, we understand. Like, but I get it to just be like, just because I'm saying these nice things doesn't mean I'm ignoring this awful shit. But at times I'm just like, this is just taking up extra space that you can, you know, to use for your point. So yeah, I think overall it's a pretty good book. It is still a bit dry. The fourth chapter is a bear to get through, you know, cause it's going through each, it goes through like, you know, Russia or sorry, USSR, China, Cuba, and it takes a while to get through all that and to get like explain the history, and some of that history I think is also probably very very condensed, so like that's not probably the whole picture for a lot of stuff. So I think it's a good book to get that historical context that we've been kind of missing from our other eco-socialist books that we've been reading.
I agree with most of that. I would honestly say this is, for what it is, this is extremely readable.
Yeah.
Like, there were very few points where I was like, my eyes skimmed over that whole page and I have to reread it.
Yeah.
So as you said, it does a really good job of breaking down methodologies and the different ways that he's going to do comparisons and debunk methods of comparison, because a lot of this book is about doing that, debunking the cultural myth in Western society that socialist states were not only bad for the environment, but worse than capitalism. And so we can never try it. And he also makes these sections that are like decently contained even in the bigger chapters, like you, especially in chapter four, which when I was reading it was 165 pages, probably not actually 165 pages because I was reading it on my phone. but it never really felt like I was just going and going and going 30, 40, 50 pages before the next like whole idea was to be presented. Is usually like 10 pages or so, and then another idea.
Yeah.
Downside to that is I feel like he, like you mentioned, he does end up repeating himself on certain points because like he's maybe approaching four or five different ideas in a chapter or 10, four or five ideas for like the USSR in chapter four and like four or five for the People's Republic of China / the Communist Party of China. And then four or five for Cuba. But then each of the ideas is based partially or entirely off of like similar facts, but going in slightly different directions. And so you end up like hearing or reading the same bit of information again to then build the foundation for the idea that he's trying to get to, which is good for like remembering, but also does make it feel like it could be a little shorter.
Yeah, that I agree with. There's like times where I read something and then like maybe four or five pages later I read it again and I'm just like, did I accidentally like not go back or something?
But yeah, as far as the history, it is condensed, obviously. Chapters 1 and 2 are essentially setting up methodology and arguing that capitalism actually isn't better. And then chapter 3 is further going into, I should probably just look at the chapters. These are my pulling up the book sounds.
They're very good sounds.
Introduction for chapter 1. Chapter 2 is a brief history of socialist states. And then 3 is going over methodology. So I had it just bumped one down, where he goes over basically the direct comparison of capitalism to socialism and debunks that. And then the synchronous comparison, which he ranks countries based on like their gross domestic product and whether they're in the core or the semi-periphery or the periphery, to more accurately compare countries based on the power of their economy. Because it's not fair to rank, to compare, say, industrializing USSR in the 30s to the United States.
Right.
Or industrializing China in the 50s to, again, the United States. And then 4 is the in-depth history. So synchronous. It was the second method, and diachronous, which means across time. So then he's looking at the idea is to look at a particular country across like a larger chunk of history, both before it was socialist, during socialism, and then after it was socialist. And he does a lot of, there's some really nice charts and graphs in here. I wish there was like a separate website where you could like overlay.
Yeah, that would be pretty sick. Yeah, that would be nice. Awesome.
But and then chapter 4 is the huge history. It was really interesting to get more of like post-Stalin USSR history.
Yes.
And also get a better idea of what actually happened in China post Mao, because like it's like, oh, Nixon went to China, it opened up, and then it's just like it's China.
Yeah,
it's like but and even still, like this is very succinct for the history that it is. So I think it would be really cool to maybe find a 2,000 or 3,000 page book and do a couple months. Maybe like 6 months, maybe a year. No, But something a bit more than 50 pages.
Yeah, I think that'd be a good idea. Just finding more of just like what did, I guess probably the issue is the book may be in a completely different language and mm-hmm. there might not be an mm-hmm. interest to get it translated to English. Mm-hmm. And or if there was a English book, it might still be, it could still be like kind of inaccurate. Could also be, you know, there could also be just issues of just like the information being kind of like off or wrong, you know, just because
purposefully skewed.
Yeah. Like either for or against, like it could just be really weird. But I think it's worth trying to find something that does do a kind of a more in-depth historical of just kind of, yeah, what were these countries doing, trying to, you know, how they looked at their, you know, especially post-war, you know, World War II, you know, China was in a very horrible position compared to like even USSR at the time, if you kind of like look at what was going on and kind of what happened there. So
yeah, I liked it a lot. I didn't have as much trouble with chapter 4 as you were making it out to be. It was fascinating and chock full of information, but not too dense.
Yeah, I just was saying, compared to the other chapters, which are about 30 or 40 pages, it's just like, oh, this one's 150, you know, 160 pages. I'm like, oh, okay.
Yeah,
it wasn't that bad. Like, there was natural stopping points. There's definitely sections. So it was, like, nice to kind of, like, all right, I'm going to read a couple sections here and still get a full picture without being like, oh, I need to read actually 5 or 6 sections because otherwise I don't understand the author's point or, you know, things like that.
I definitely can see a world where this book has that chapter broken up into 3 chapters.
Yes.
In fact, I don't see why that didn't happen, because it's functionally designed as 3 chapters in a chapter.
Yeah.
So, and then chapter 5, we get some of just our favorite, just a tasty, tasty meal. Everybody knows. Every longtime listener knows we get some dialectics.
Oh yeah,
and is good. It's mostly just a wrap up chapter, but also like a reminder that the ecology and the economy aren't the only factors to consider, and then how they interplay is not as straightforward as one might imagine.
Yeah, it was pretty short. Like, it was very, it was a wrap-up chapter. It was very interesting. I think the fact that there wasn't anything like, hey, we need to do X, Y, and Z, besides, like, hey, if, like, we keep going on this capitalism choo-choo train, like, we're just gonna not have, like, any Earth left. It was very, like, all right, so if we're gonna, like, do socialism, like, please understand that there's like we have a historical, like, you know, knowledge here to make decisions to make it make sense, and also yes, we need to include all these other aspects of it. So which I don't know, for some people that might not be satisfying, because like sometimes it's like I want steps, and others like, okay, yeah, good, like, or kind of like, yeah, I know. You know, it might be like, yes, I know, thank you very much.
Yeah, I mean, anyone who's reading this book, I feel like, will probably be okay with there not being concrete steps, because if you're familiar at all with historical materialism and dialectical materialism, then you know that everything is dependent on the conditions on the ground. You cannot, there's no one size fits all. Because, I mean, one of the examples in that last chapter was, what was it, Hungary's soil?
Yes.
Yeah, and how, depending on where you were in the country, they were industrializing their farming significantly, and the industrial farming had different impacts depending on where you were, because of the history and the landscape of the area being different, resulting in the soil being different, and then the industrial farming methods introducing fertilizers and introducing like more topsoil, like turnover, doing different things.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's unfortunately, it's just going to be struggle sessions all the way down.
Yeah. That actually kind of reminds me of, I've been reading books about Vikings and stuff like that. And one thing that was very telling was they went over to Iceland and they essentially were like, all right, we're going to do the exact same farming methods that we've done mm-hmm. in fucking Finland. Mm-hmm. And it was a failed colony because they all fucking died like after mm-hmm. like a decade because they just cut down all the trees and were like, oh shit, like, yeah, we can't do this. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's like the problem of people like, all right, we're gonna go to this other area. We're gonna like totally not sit here and study, figure out how this anything works. We're just gonna use the same exact method, and then it's like surprise Pikachu, you don't get any yield, and you just fucking die. So
yep.
You know.
Yep. So, which any good home gardener would be like, well, duh. But then also, they were Vikings. They didn't have home gardening manuals. They didn't have YouTube to tell them how to determine the pH balance of their lawn. Yeah.
They were just like, all right, it's dirt. There's dirt at home. Should be easy peasy. Like, I think that, you know, the climate's still kind of the same, I think, you know.
Hey, Viking chief, can we get soil? No, we've got soil at home.
Exactly.
So, yeah. Great book, would recommend if you have any socialist leanings whatsoever, because it will give you ammo when you're arguing with your family members. It also will probably give you a bit more history than you've gotten unless you're better than us, which if you are, stop rubbing it in our faces.
Yeah, for real.
Would recommend.
All right. Rolling into our discussion questions. So what was, like, your previous knowledge of the relationship of social states and the environment? Because, like, at the beginning of this book, they're like, ah, there's myths that being a socialist state does not improve the environment or makes it worse. Mm. And I personally have not heard that thing exactly. The only thing I've really heard about was Chernobyl, and that was it. And I guess maybe people are like, well, Chernobyl, and that kind of was, like, the end of the argument, when it's not. Like, it's just one, like, one accident.
Accident. Yeah. I had also heard of the Sparrows movement.
Okay. Can you explain what which, that is?
Yeah. So in China, as part of the, I think it's a part of the Cultural Revolution, or maybe at the same time, but not technically part of it, it was suggested that to improve, because like they're coming out of a civil war, 45 to 49. Previously, prior to the civil war, there was still like World War II and like the rape in Nanking and all sorts of like Japanese imperialism and also internal struggles pretty much from the 20s onward, but official civil war, 45 to 49. And then there was a famine, if I'm remembering correctly, in the mid-50s, or might have been the early 60s, I can't remember. Either way, they needed to improve crop yields to improve the like total nutrition of the people of China. And so the idea was, oh, well, a lot of our crops are being eaten by birds, in particular sparrows. So kill all the sparrows you can find. And then they had like issues with locusts as a result.
Oh.
So that was another like bigger one that I knew of before reading all of this, which didn't get touched on here, which was interesting.
Yeah. There was another, I forgot, there was a Behind the Bastards about, that one fucking scientist.
Lysenko.
Yeah. Or, okay. Yeah. But was that, I don't know. That was like, that's kind of like, once again, it's like an interesting tidbit of just like, yeah, there was some dumbass who had like who was like, yes, let's just do something completely just not how everybody else does it. Like, yeah. Basic.
His big thing was, well, we're good communists, so we need to treat the plants like they're communists too. So if we plant all the seeds in a single hole, they will grow stronger together.
Yeah.
And also trying to figure out how to deal with growing things in permafrost and being like, oh, if we just freeze the seeds and then plant them in the permafrost, it'll be fun. And then, no.
Yeah.
I think part of the reason why it's not gone over here is, one, it's early, if I'm remembering correctly, like 20s through the 40s, like mid-20s through the 40s. And also, it's not, like, he also didn't really, like, go over or touch the famines in the 30s.
Yeah.
Which might be a good call just because of how contentious they are in the historical record. Like,
yeah.
Some people call it a genocide. Some people call it, like, a famine that was just mismanaged. Like, there's a lot of different positions here. And I think for the purposes of this book, it would have dragged the book down and wasted a lot of time sifting through that. Like, that's the sort of topic that needs its own book entirely.
Yeah. And, like, it's kind of a... It's also kind of a side quest in a way, too. Because it's like, all right, we can talk about just how we did stuff. But, like, famine is, if I, like, understand, there's a lot of, like, it's not just, like, oh, your crops failed and people starve. There's a lot of, like, governmental, like, bureaucratic stuff that goes into it. It's not just, okay, we just don't have food and we starve. Like, you know, the potato famine was not like, oh, yeah, we didn't have potatoes. They just straight up didn't give them any fucking food.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, yeah, figuring out, did they actually, you know, actually withheld it? Who said what? You know, there's probably just a lot of, like, we had to sift through all that, sift through actual, you know, personal accounts. Do we trust those personal accounts? Yada, yada, yada.
Exactly.
It's, yeah.
Messy. Incredibly messy. Versus, like, the actual data is much cleaner, especially the data from the 50s onward.
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I think a lot of, like, the myth of, like, oh, social states are, like, bad environmentally, I've never really heard of that. It's been mostly the economy that has always get focused on. Which
makes some sense, because it's like, that's all people seem to really care about in the U.S.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. Like, I, you know, that's what I've, you know, it's like, comes to, like, you know, Earth stuff is kind of like, yeah, it's there. You know, it is what it is.
But yeah, beyond that, I didn't really know much. And that's about it.
Yeah. All right. For next discussion, so for each state, what were some patterns that you picked up on? Just in terms of, just for each state, kind of, you know, what were some things that they did to try to, like, reverse course or discover, like, oh, we need to do XYZ or, you know, put studies or whatever.
Sure. So obviously, I think for all of our listeners, you'll at least know before we go into that, this book ostensibly is about three countries, at least in the sense that that is what is focused on in the largest and most in-depth chapter. But a good part of his argument is that most people pretend that there were only ever three socialist states.
Yeah.
Maybe four, if you include, or five, Vietnam and North Korea. But his count is 28?
Yeah, just about.
If I'm remembering correctly. Yeah. Most of which weren't industrial and never got a chance to industrialize. primarily because the United States or another core capitalist country essentially murdered as many people as they had to stop the socialist state from being socialist. So that is why the focus is basically on these three countries. Is one, they're the three countries with the most data. I mean, we probably could get a little bit of data from North Korea, but not nearly as much as the others. Vietnam is kind of, the data for Vietnam's a little warped by the fact that the United States bombed the piss out of it.
Yeah.
And kind of hard to make any sort of environmental judgments on a country where you were napalming children.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's why these three are focused on. But there were 28 countries that are talked about at some point in this book. So as far as the other 25, the pattern is what I just described. For these three, at least the initial pattern is overcoming colonialism.
Yeah.
Ending a feudal period, essentially.
Yeah.
And do you want to keep going? Or do you want me to keep going?
Oh, I can go. But yeah, so kind of the, yeah, ending, gaining some autonomy, and then rapidly industrializing.
Trying to
do that, and also have the unfortunate position of we also have to defend ourselves, because they're generally are coming out of a armed conflict or something of the other. And also there's definitely key players from the externally that are trying to fuck your shit up. So you're kind of focusing on, all right, I need to, you know, try to get enough men and guns, and also feed everybody. Because there was also kind of a boom, boom period of just like population growth for some. So once things kind of quote unquote stabilized, but they nothing was truly stabilized. There was it was kind of just there's just a period of months probably where things were okay. You aren't getting attacked from the outside. You might start seeing some shit from the inside and being like, please don't, but all right, we're going to deal with our internal party strife. It quickly becomes when things are kind of sort of settled for a minute of how do we efficiently, or there's generally scientists and some other students from colleges who are kind of hey, I know we're industrializing, but most of these rivers are fucking starting to get poisoned and shit. This crops are getting all fucked up. The ground around here is getting fucked up.
This was a river.
Yes.
And now there's nothing here.
Yeah. This is kind of one of the things that I wish it wasn't glossed over, but there were scientists and other folks who were just this is very important. We need to make moves to have some type of organization or something. The government needs to care about this. It can't just be us on the peripheral, giving a shit. So some took it, I think all three countries took it as serious as that they could. Russia was in a very unique position where they had a really big timber export. Because they were cutting down a lot of people needed fucking timber. And they were yeah, we can do that.
Yeah.
So,
and a lot of that, you'd think, oh, they're socialist countries, why are they exporting things? It's as much as they tried to industrialize with materials inside the country, they weren't proponents of Juche. So even though the US and the USSR were in a Cold War, there was still trade going on. There were still loans given to the USSR, which they in turn had to pay back. Those loans were used to buy equipment that they couldn't make themselves. And that that was a lot of the drive and the issue for the ecology of these countries. Is part of industrializing meant that they couldn't just industrialize to make enough for their people. They also had to then make enough profit to pay back these loans with interest.
Yeah. So there was always a issue between, hey, we need to pay this back, and hey, by the way, we shrunk our fucking forests by X percent mm-hmm. this year. And also the general hey, we need money to go do, make sure we have a fucking river, and then be maybe you'll have mm-hmm. this money. So there's the internal pressures of doing stuff. I think if I read correctly, USSR also did loans to, I want to say, Cuba and yes. other socialist states. Yeah.
Yes.
Which I thought was interesting. That was something I did not know. Mm-hmm. And I have feelings about it. I feel like if you're trying to do a true socialist role, do you really do loans? But maybe was it a 0% loan? You know, one of those situations. Sure. Yeah. Or, I don't know. He didn't really explain those loan terms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would have been interesting to get into. But I also feel like I would again. Really slow the book down.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So I understand why he didn't.
But I it kind of seemed from those loans and some of those agreements soured the relationship between everybody after a point of just mm-hmm. I don't know. It just seemed just including that plus external pressures from the US and everything else quickly soured how everybody was looking at the USSR. And I know China and Russia also had a spat, and then mm-hmm. they just, there was a betrayal as put in the book.
Yeah. So at least with Cuba, the relationship with the USSR was ongoing until the fall of the USSR,
yes.
which is what put Cuba into such dire economic straits through the 90s and forced them to essentially reconsider their economy and reapproach how they were doing that, and gave them the chance to make their economy ecologically focused.
Yes. Unfortunately for China and the USSR, they just never gotten more than a decade or two, and I think China even less, of to actually right size ecologically. Mm-hmm. They pretty much were industrialized, all right, we're gonna try to right size some things, and then oh fuck, we're collapsing, now we're a capitalist entity. Mm-hmm. Everything just shoots mm-hmm. back up in terms of CO2 and NO2 or N2O, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And
something that the author does is he does make a distinction between, for China, they were not state socialist after, was it 78?
Correct, yeah.
Yeah. So they were a socialist government with a capitalist economy.
Right.
And he does a very good job of pointing out that just because it is a socialist government and the government has some ownership stakes and controls a few industries, and he also points this out about Venezuela as well, does not mean that they control the economy, and does not mean that they can control individual businesses and their behaviors.
Right. They can influence them and be mm-hmm. Hey, you can do that, but I need to get my scratch. But they're mm-hmm. not always, yeah, they're not you can't do that.
Yep. So it essentially is treating China and counting China after 78 in the capitalist pile, which makes sense to
yeah.
me, especially since they've functionally just been the manufacturing sector for the United States and secondarily for the rest of the world since 78.
Yeah. something else that I realized I want to point out. So a lot of the, like, China, Cuba, and USSR, they didn't have, like, other colonized states to offload mm-hmm. all of their industry like mm-hmm. the U.S. did. Like, especially during the post-World War II up until, like, 70s/90 to the 90s. So, like, mm-hmm. Pretty much, yeah, as, like, we kind of mentioned, and, like, you mentioned that, you know, USSR had to, like, go and ask, try to, you know, import in equipment because they just couldn't make it inside mm-hmm. their own country. Unlike mm-hmm. the U.S., which is like, oh, we need equipment. We're just going to go ask one of our allies, or, you know, we'll set up a trade thing there and, like, deal with it. And or, you know, maybe make it in-house. But most of the time, mm-hmm. generally go and, like, get tools or whatever from elsewhere.
Yeah. There is an argument to be made that the way the USSR functioned was essentially a semi-colonial effort in the way that it treated, like, Kazakhstan
yes.
and Ukraine and Belarus, what have you, Romania. But there was significant independence in a fair number of ways that you don't typically see with, like, actual colonial relations. It's not the same as, like, the U.S. and Puerto Rico, or the U.S. and that we invaded in, like, 1905? Wasn't Singapore?
Philippines.
Yep. Nor was it like the UK and South Africa, or Australia, or et cetera, et cetera. And then in the modern era, there is kind of like a bit of a colonial streak going on with China right now. But it's not, necessarily as, like, direct or as immediately obvious that is what it somewhat is like, or somewhat is, but they are starting to pull in resources from periphery countries in a similar manner that colonial states were doing 75 to 100 years ago.
We need to get a book on that. That's an interesting topic, because there's a very vast amount of opinions about that.
As an argument, how much of that effort is just to satisfy U.S. and European markets?
Yeah, that's true.
So how much of it is just indirect colonialism? So neo-colonialism from the U.S. and Europe. We're no longer getting our hands dirty doing the deals ourselves. We're now making deals with China, who in turn makes deals with periphery countries to gather the resources necessary to make the things that we then buy.
Yeah, it's very interesting how very interconnected a lot of things can get, and just very messy. Mm-hmm. And, like, kind of how we ended up here was just everybody got wrecked, essentially, and some people took advantage. Like, that mm-hmm. that is kind of how it worked out. Of, you know, unfortunately, the socialist states kind of fractured, you know, not kind of, they fractured, and mm-hmm. nobody, you know, there was just a bunch of internal fighting mm-hmm. that, you know, when somebody else comes out with, like, a better deal, and, like, and my people are starving, yeah, you're gonna take that fucking deal. Like, I don't, it's either, oh, this guy who is an asshole to me, that's not gonna help feed my people, or, all right, I guess I'll get with my enemy, because at the end of the day, people won't go starving, and maybe we'll work, like, maybe we can work it out to, it's still to my advantage, or whatever. It sucks. Like, that's just kind of how it, like, ended up, was just a bunch of pressure to try to defend this new way of life against a bunch of people who just couldn't just leave well enough alone. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's how they did. And the fact that they managed to try to reverse a lot of their industrialization efforts in terms of just trying to, you know, do reforestation, mm-hmm. bring back rivers, make sure they're not fucked up and all this other stuff, have a focus on ecology and like different areas of like study is very it's very cool, like very like a very mm-hmm. good thing that they managed to do despite yeah. all the shit was going on.
Yeah. And I think that's the biggest takeaway, other than like a turn to capitalism is a turn to pollution, which just makes sense.
Yeah.
Like, as much as like, oh, green capital, it's like, where are the resources coming from? How do you extract the resources? Oh, it requires mining? Oh, okay. So where have you ever heard of clean mining?
Yeah.
Clean mineral extraction. It doesn't exist. Yeah. So it's the other thing that I took away from this book is Cuba.
Yeah.
Pretty cool. Pretty fucking cool. Still has its problems, still has its issues. But absolutely a model for both the periphery and semi-periphery countries, and also a model for what the US could be and other core capitalist countries could and should be doing.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the fact that they managed to, after everything collapsed, managed to turn everything around and figure out how to, you know, do their urban gardens, how to just adjust everything and, you know, not have to kind of hit the, like, break glass, like, I guess we just abandon everything button, mm-hmm. you know, is very, very noble.
Yeah. And honestly, the most impressive part about it is, like, as much as, like, the USSR was able to do a lot, I feel like on the scale of the resources available to Cuba versus what they were able to do, like, it's leaps and bounds beyond. And that's in spite of the fact that, like, the USSR and China both were, at least the USSR during the USSR, was indirectly trading with the US.
Yeah.
Was trading with Europe and was able to get loans from Europe. China was able to get loans from the USSR and also had a lot more resources for itself.
Yeah.
Cuba was able to get loans and materials and equipment from the USSR, but also, like, much smaller space. Can't really set
yeah.
a ton of industry up on Cuba versus, say, China. And then the fact that the U.S. is still refusing to trade with Cuba and still has an economic embargo on Cuba, like, it's pretty incredible.
Yeah. All right. I think we definitely hit all the patterns we saw. Mm-hmm. So kind of mentioned earlier in the book, or oh my gosh, earlier in the podcast, we're actually in a book, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. that the solutions offered weren't really like step-by-step solutions, but what was missing in terms of solutions? There's kind of one answer for this. There is an actual answer for this.
What was missing? Renewables?
No. No, I'm going to say no. I thought it was interesting that there was no mention of degrowth. And unless I missed it, I didn't see anything about that. But
I feel like it was implied.
Mm.
Because the only way that a capitalist country can reach the, like, pollution levels of socialist countries would be to stop growing and restrict and contract.
Okay.
IMO. Like, there's as much as, like, oh my God. And of course, yesterday I got into, not going to say an argument, but saw a post about like renewable energy, and I said there aren't enough rare earth metals on the planet for all of the world to meet its current energy needs and then growing energy needs with just renewables. And people jumped down my throat because, of course, that's what you do on the internet. It's you're right. It's not explicitly said nor like discussed how it would happen,
right,
or what that would entail. But I feel like that would be just another couple chapters if he were to look at like Europe and China and the US and be like, how do these countries degrowth? How do they transition to socialist economies and have eco-socialist outcomes?
Mm.
So I understand why the book avoided it. And also the fact that the book is supposed to be a defense of socialist states from the ecologist position.
Yeah. The review that I posted, New Environmental History of Socialist States, posted on monthlyreview.org. That was like mentioned as a critique, like not really, but it was just kind of like, oh, it was interesting that they didn't mention degrowth. Now that you kind of said like, well, it's kind of implied, I can see that from like, yeah, if we're not always infinitely growing, then like, what are we doing? Like, we're either maintaining or, yeah, contracting. So, yep.
And with inflation, maintaining is contracting.
Right, right.
So, yeah. And the article or review author does mention that the author of this book did have a... So he's an editor for a magazine, and in 2012 and then 2019 had, as one of the monthly editions, like a focus on degrowth.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So it's definitely something that the author is aware of. While eco-socialists and current advocates of degrowth have not always seen eye to eye, Engel D. Morrow has played a significant role in helping bridge these divides by hosting two discussion forums on degrowth ideas in capitalism, science, socialism, capitalism, nature, socialism, in 2012 and 2019. Judging from these editorials, he became more open to the possibility of a unification of these two approaches over the interim. Quote, though degrowth perspectives barely feature in the analysis of socialist states and the environment, one hopes that he and other eco-socialists might be willing to engage with them explicitly on the question of what we should learn from the past leftist efforts to fight for social equality and environmental integrity.
Okay, so it seems like based on that, there's been, I guess, two tracks of thought of like degrowth and then just like let's just do an eco socialism. So, it's kind of interesting that there seems to be like kind of a two paths, but hopefully might start coming together or probably taking ideas from each other, you know, as we plod along here.
Yeah. I certainly feel like if degrowth were to happen in the US, it would imply that there has been a complete collapse of the United States as a government and as an economy, because there just is not the in the politics of the US there is not any sort of inkling that this is something that needs to happen, let alone is good to happen. There's no political support for it, at least as far as mainstream politicians from the national level down to the local level, at least that I'm aware of.
It's definitely a very, it's not even considered in the US, and it's like a very even fringe thought for even leftists, I feel like. I don't hear a lot about degrowth beyond like a couple YouTubers and just some of the books like we've been reading. I picked it up from like other like areas, but it's not like immediate focus. And granted, I understand that. Like, there are other issues that are just going on that are a little bit more just present, but it's just kind of like, you know, it's for me, like, think about degrowth is kind of future proofing yourself of like, okay, what happens when like we don't have a capitalist system in the US? Like, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. And like, how do we deal with a bunch of like, quote unquote, reversing some of these decisions that were made? And granted, you know, a lot of this stuff is, you know, 200 years old at this point. So just in terms of just like how we change the lay of the land and things like that. Mm-hmm. So it's, yeah.
And there's also that I can see why eco-socialists wouldn't want to like start with degrowth, because eco-socialists want like revolution and then an ecologically focused revolution at that.
Yeah.
And degrowth implies continuing to be capitalist, or doesn't necessarily imply a turn towards socialism. It could just be a contracting capitalist society.
That's true, yeah.
So it like degrowth and eco-socialism have to be explicitly paired. And eco-socialism, I feel like, implies degrowth, because if you are, one, if you're socialist, if the world were to snap of a finger become socialist, we're no longer producing for the purposes of growing GDP and growing the value of stockholders' holdings.
Right.
Whereas, like I already said, plenty of capitalist countries have done degrowth accidentally just by having a financial catastrophe.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess we could say degrowth could be like a policy that could be a socialist, in a socialist or capitalist thing. However, leading off like as an eco-socialist, you might be like, we need to just get a seat at the fucking table, or rip up the table and make our own table, yes. You know, and saying like, yeah, we're going to do degrowth. And everyone's like, yeah, bro, like we're not even there yet. Like we can't even, we don't control jack shit. Like, yeah. So.
Yep.
Yeah. All right. Speaking of degrowth. So, you know, we read Half Earth Socialism, and the reason why I picked up or suggested this book was that there's a critique on one of, I think, Cosmo, I forgot what the site was. Anyway, there was a review.
Cosmopolitan.
Yeah. There was a review, and they were like, man, Verso books, them and the Verso books, goddamn Verso books. They were like, yeah, this isn't as good as this book. Mm-hmm. And I guess I'm just gonna, you know, just asking, like, should we even compare these two books after learning about differences of comparisons? Should we even compare these two books, or is it like, does one do better? Does one book do something better than the other? Is it worth even having this like conversation about it?
I think they have different purposes.
Yes.
So I don't think it's a fair comparison. I also, outside of the last chapter of Half Earth Socialism and a couple tidbits about it, I don't remember much of it.
Yeah, I mean, if anything, Half of Socialism was just trying to get you into like, okay, this is what a degrowth movement and what degrowth would look like. And that is it. There is unfortunately not a whole lot of historical stuff, but like that wasn't like really the point.
Yes.
This is definitely a more historical book.
Absolutely. Right. Okay. So there were discussions about like cybernetics and cyber socialism, and then also discussion about the how to determine how much land to leave for nature to take back to restore the maximum amount of biodiversity. Okay. Yeah. I would say that they're complementary. Comparing them it doesn't really get us anywhere because their aims are different. Mutually beneficial, but different.
Yeah, I feel like it's kind of like the next step. Like, kind of as we mentioned before, like, oh, why, you know, it's kind of like, okay, so once we, you know, yeah, snap fingers, don't have capitalism, what does, you know, eco-socialism look like? And degrowth could be a part of that. But it's mm-hmm. not like this is a policy that we're, like, everybody agrees on. So, yeah, I'm trying to, like, suss out, like, why, like, this book was even brought up with, like, half-earth socialism. But perhaps the author of the review just was, like, I preferred a more historical, maybe more, like, quote-unquote grounded type of mm-hmm. a book than mm-hmm. kind of this utopia type stuff, which, you know, we definitely have been reading, you know, a bunch of different socialist authors, and there's a lot of arguments of, like, yes, we should do a utopia, like, think of a utopia. No, we shouldn't think of a utopia, or, like, in the mm-hmm. middle type of, you know, conversation.
Mm-hmm. You know, as much as there's, like, a yes and no utopia, not utopia, this book, a couple things I actually enjoy, one thing that I enjoyed about this book that occurred a couple times was me being like, oh, we've read that, or, yeah. Oh, we read part of that with respect to Arrighi.
Yeah.
But there was also, with respect to, I think, Cuba, a word used that I have only ever heard used by Utopian Socialist podcast that I was listening to a couple of years ago, and that's usufruct.
Oh yeah.
And it, like, I can't see this author and really anyone who is serious about socialism, like, I feel like you have to have two minds about it, because you have to, like, if you forget the utopia that you're aiming for, you will make decisions that are politically or economically or socially expedient.
Yes.
But if you forget to be grounded, you also can make decisions that will result in people rejecting the system that you're trying to build before you can even really build it.
Yeah. As humans, we're really bad at long-term planning. Like, we mm-hmm. cannot imagine. Like, we're like, yeah, we kind of weirdly enough lie to ourselves. We're like, yes, in 5 years, I'll be in X spot. And that usually is not always the case. We're mm-hmm. pretty good at predicting, like, maybe a month or two.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a year. But generally, beyond that, we are, like, very not, like, think about 10 years ahead, impossible. You know, yeah. Like, we're not good at doing that. So you have to consider, like, yeah, we need to do, like, results kind of in front of your faces, but not sacrifice the long-term mm-hmm. goal, mm-hmm. which is a very interesting balance to try to maintain.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think, kind of as you said, I think both books have different, they're hitting different points. And I was like, when I was reading this, I'm like, okay, what is this book supposed to be different about Half Earth Socialism? And yeah, I was just like, there's not really anything to compare. So, So anything else, Jimmy?
I would say also that Half Earth Socialism definitely has more of a animals first
yeah.
sort of approach to thinking about ecology. Whereas a lot of this book is, as much as, like, animals are there, it is more so thinking about just land and air and water.
Yeah.
There are some mention of animals, but yeah. No, it's mostly those three when these are considered and talked about, which, you know, fair. Those are the building blocks for animals, but... Something it does also mention is, like, if you wipe out a forest and then you later come back and replant the forest, it doesn't mean that the forest you've replanted is going to be like biodiverse.
Yeah.
Like you could just plant maple trees in a row. That's not going to lead to a return of the plants and animals that were there before.
Yeah. Yeah, it was definitely more the global effects of what's going on than kind of the, sorry, I should say it's the like macro and stuff like mm-hmm. kind of the micro in some aspects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which I think for some people who are like, granted, like if you're not very much into socialism or you're kind of like skeptical or, you know, you maybe just like, I don't know, does state socialists do better this way? Like this book does kind of give you kind of the more macro level of just kind of like, here's how, like, let's just look at the data. Here's this mm-hmm. data. And then you're like, oh, okay. This like, okay, I have things to think about now compared yes. to, yeah, if somebody who isn't really socialist leaning, pick up half or socialism, probably be like, what is this bullshit? Why should we regrow, you know, half the mm-hmm. earth, like that type of thing. So, you know, I feel like, yeah, there's like that kind of difference there too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. Speaking of this book, because our next two books are going to be related. So for May, we're going to read kind of a chonker, Midnight in Chernobyl, The Untold Story of the World's Greatest Nuclear Disaster. I think some of this book was probably used for the Chernobyl HBO show. There's going to be a lot of names and a lot of dates. So we're going to probably... Oh, and a lot of Russian names that we're going to fuck up. Sorry, Ukrainian. A lot of Ukrainian names that we're going to butcher. So I'm mm-hmm. sorry. For mm-hmm. June, mm-hmm. we're reading Slow Down. This is a book by Kohei Sato. I think he's wrote like another book... another like degrowth like book or something. He's been kind of tearing up the eco-socialist like internet degrowth movement. I've heard his name with a couple articles, so it's nice to get something translated from him. So that's mm-hmm. pretty cool. And then we're going to take a nice detour into fiction land. We're gonna read another Murderbot book, The Artificial Conditions. It's the second book. So read the first one. Although you don't really have to read the first one, but you can read the second one, but you're probably like, what the fuck, like, who's this character? But the first one's good, and it's short, and we did an episode on yeah. it, like, last year or so.
Also, who's this character? Oh, he's a murder bot, but he also has control over himself versus other murder bots. There you go, that's character.
Yeah, also, they love soap operas, okay? They just want mm-hmm. to be left alone to watch their soap operas and then go home. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Now, remember, books are
good.
Actually